Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Where do inspiration and liberation come alive for oppressed people the world over? In Ireland's stories, reports our guest Frank Delaney. A former BBC journalist and author, Mr. Delaney's many novels include the bestseller Ireland and Tipperary. Mr. Delaney is forever working to answer his own intriguing question. How is it a tiny island on the edge of Europe dropped such a huge wide green stripe all around the globe? Is it perhaps the luck of the Irish or something much, much greater?
The luck of the Irish is a very mercurial thing. And it is not luck at all, in my view. It is based entirely on the fact that because we're Celts, an ancient, proud European race, we can do something that almost no other race has ever been able to do. We can hold utterly opposite beliefs simultaneously. It's just like listening to an Irish tune. When you allow the mind that kind of unfettered imagination, then you are the legislator of the law of unintended consequences. I think it was Shelley said that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. Well, the Irish are the unacknowledged luck makers of the world. You make your own luck. And the more you try, and the more you push the imagination, and the more you put pressure on what the imagination can yield, it's said we only use 10% of our minds anyway, then you get luck.
Frank Delaney was born in Tipperary, Ireland. For decades, he worked for the BBC, and he's published more than 20 books. In addition to providing fictional entree into the Emerald Isle's rich culture, history, and current realities, Mr. Delaney debuted his nonfiction in the U.S. with his book Simple Courage. In addition to his broadcasting career, Mr. Delaney is a judge for the prestigious Booker Prize in the UK and writes frequently for American and British publications. Since 2002, he's made his home in the United States. Bill Russell and I have a special affinity for all things Celtic, so we were delighted to welcome a certified Irish storyteller who, true to his heritage, is as charming as he is knowledgeable.
Frank Delaney, I grew up unknowingly in a mixed marriage. It was bicultural. One side of the family was a lot of fun. They were English, Irish, Welsh, and Scots with a very heavy emphasis on the Irish, and the other was Teutonic German. This is a mixed marriage.
That is a mixed marriage.
Well, I didn't really understand why I had such a good time with the relatives on one side, and it was pretty awful and somber on the other side. Until I grew up and I looked and said, the stories we tell matter. Is that what we're trying to do with our fiction and our nonfiction when we are Frank Delaney?
Oh, gosh, the stories we all tell matter. It's interesting to think about story at this stage of man's civilization. But when you start to analyze it and look at where story is, people talk about the narrative in music. Narrative painters, the Impressionists were in many ways narrative painters. Journalists talk about getting the story. It is ultimately our primary form of communication in terms of expression. Obviously we have the super primary forms like conversation and eye contact and so on and so forth. But in terms of the conveyancing of the proceedings of one spirit to another, it's best done in story. And I've always been intrigued since I was a small boy by the fact that the greatest part of the word history is made by the word story.
And when somebody takes that word and manipulates it to say his story or her story, they've cut into
the essence.
They're missing
the point. They're missing the point completely. It's ultimately about the way we are permitted to use the proceedings, to bring the proceedings of our imagination to bear upon facts. You know, never let the facts get in the way of a good story is what they say about flawed journalists, but they should say it about talented novelists.
Indeed.
This is a direction I hadn't expected. My brother years ago introduced me to the notion of a word called phatics. fairly obscure.
P-H-A-T-I-C-S.
And it essentially describes content-free, essentially, language. Essentially, social grooming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Turns out to be a substantial part of what most conversations are about. The point is not the content. It is just the engagement, the grooming that goes on between and among people. The stories is where the content is.
Different matter.
Mm-hmm.
And everything around that is gloss, it's largely...
It's grooming!
It's social
grooming. It's so interesting that you say this. Several years ago, I used to do a language show on the BBC called Word of Mouth, in which we looked at how we spoke and the things we say. And one of the things we discovered in that in Britain there was going on, this fascinates me, a national observation where thousands of people all over the country wore, for 7 days, low-powered, slow tape recorders, and everything they said in their families, and they were carefully selected, scientifically selected groups, was noted down, was and then transcribed. When you read the transcripts of a family, a typical working class, lower middle class, upper middle class family at dinner in the evening, and listen to what they're saying, the thing I was immediately struck by was the absence of long passages. Therefore, there was no story going on. Now, I've been accustomed to reading court transcripts as a reporter, and court transcripts are fascinating because they fall into two parts. This is speaking to your point. They're full of phatics, but phatics with a barb, where one lawyer is trying to get the advantage of a witness. And then you get the witness statements, and that's where the story comes in. And the difference is this. Here is the total difference. The power, the strength, is in the story. Let me give you one other quick example. I wrote a book some years ago called Simple Courage about a sea disaster in which all the crew who survived gave evidence to the U.S. Coast Guard in Lafayette Street in New York. And some of them had language challenges and so on and so forth. It was a multinational crew. And the chairman of the board, a wonderful naval officer called Shackleton, was interviewing people very carefully. Snippets of questions, snippets of answer. And then, on the last day, the star of the show appears, the captain who has survived. And he gives evidence. And his evidence runs uninterrupted for several pages at a time. Uninterrupted. And it is utterly brilliant. Why? Because he is telling the story of what happened.
I would think, this is a leap, but it's congruent. I would think that in some ways, the story he was able to tell, he was able to tell because he had that sense of continuity. He lived his life that way so that he had I think that's part of the courage, that kind of integrity.
I hadn't thought of that.
That allows you to see things in continuity, in coherence, and over both in space, but also over time.
Plus
a theory.
Plus the fact, Bill, that he was a Scandinavian and accustomed to long stories.
Indeed, and we will have a short story for a moment, and come right back with Frank Delaney, who will, in fact, we'll see how much continuity we can develop in this story. Be back with us when we return. Frank Delaney has delightedly joined us in conversation. Bill Russell, you were putting forth the possibility of integrity in the midst of that. We have a friend who won the Ulysses Prize for literary reportage. She's Alexandra Fuller, and she says her job as a reporter, a literary reporter, is what she got the award for, and it's a good description, affirmation. She says her job is to be a connector, that she goes out to find the dots and then to connect them. And in a way, that's what I'm hearing both of you say about stories.
Yes. I want to be more than a connector. I want to be a driver. I want to take you into a book that I've written. I will know my purpose beforehand. And I want to keep you there. First of all, on the simple value for money basis. I want to entertain you. Let me entertain you. That's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to keep you there because you, the reader, and this is very important to me, you, the reader, are going to help me, because I'm writing for you, make sense of my own life through what I'm writing. make order out of my own chaos. And the more I can grip you with a story, the better I can do that. So in terms of connector, yes, by all means, join all the dots. But I start, when I'm setting out a book, I have never, ever known the end of a book. I've just delivered a novel to my publishers, which comes out next March. It's called Shannon. And I did not know how the book was going to end.
Is that a little alarming?
This was very alarming. This is seriously alarming because this is the whole function of the book hinged on the final decision. And the final decision comes, as it happens, quite naturally, in the second last sentence of the book.
Did it surprise you?
It did. It did startle me, but it's completely right. And it was based entirely on the character's integrity. But here's the point. It was another character in the book who told me how the book was going to end. That fascinates me.
In Ireland, you talk about poetry coming out of the sky, that all those words live there and they're just waiting.
Of course they do, Paula. Where else are they gone? You know, all these words that we're speaking here now, they're going out through that door there and they're going up into the ether. Somebody else will borrow those one day and hold on a bunch of them when he wants them and say, hey guys, look what I found, you know. He may even use them playing Scrabble.
Writing novels seems to me to be a two-step creative process. I think of E.L. Doctorow talking about his experience writing the book and then seeing what he has written as he gets responses from readers. And trying the story he thinks he's telling and the story other people read, and ultimately the final creation is really a creation. It's a public creation amongst the general audience and the author, but it's also a very personal creation between the individual reader,
yes,
and the author and the story, and that troika, if you will, is I think for every person unique. Because much of what the story says is it comes from your own experience, what you bring to it, and that ongoing series of creativity in a narrative way seems to me to be at the center of what makes us human, and at our best makes us the children of angels.
You lead your readers into telling them what they think of you. I've got an interesting thing happening to me in the United States. I've been living here now for 6 years, and these books have been published in the United States, Ireland and Tipperary. And what I'm getting is something that I've never had before, is the one-to-one response I'm getting from readers is intense.
Hmm.
Of a kind I've never had in my life before.
This didn't happen in the United Kingdom?
No, and nor in Ireland, and it didn't happen in broadcasting. The emotional response of people who come to me and talk about these books is peculiarly intense.
Well, that is to say, you have written books that have been widely available in the UK.
Over 20 books published, you know. I wrote three novels of a set of five yet to be finished about the Holocaust, and didn't provoke anything like these reactions. But there's been a personal thing here that has quite staggered me. And this is what I think it's about. There's a very good English novelist, now forgotten sadly, called Henry Green, who wrote Living, Loving, Party Giving, beautifully wrought pieces of work. Small novels, but, you know, he cut them like a gemologist, cut stones. Mm. Beautiful. And he described the relationship between writer and reader as an intimacy between strangers. But I don't have readers. I have a reader.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who that reader is, but I know it is somebody that I must respect, whose intelligence I may never underestimate, but whose knowledge I'm entitled to underestimate.
Which is what you have your storyteller in Ireland say.
Absolutely. That's completely right. He speaks for me in many ways. And, Nabokov said that the novelist is three things. He's a teacher, or a storyteller, or a magician. And then Nabokov said, and the great novelist like me is all three. But that's the aspiration.
He has license to say that.
I agree.
But
with great respect to Mr. Nabokov, I would have said it might have come better at the end of his life rather than at the beginning.
Well, there's that.
And he might have said, and that is my aspiration,
no.
Which is certainly my aspiration, but I'd settled for one. And now here's the interesting thing. I then have to ask myself, if you could have only one,
yes,
which would you want? And B, which do you think you are?
Okay, do it again.
A teacher, a storyteller, or a magician?
And of course the answer is?
A magician.
Of course.
Right. But so what do I think I am? I think I'm a teacher. Now, other people say I'm a storyteller, but I think I'm a teacher.
And what is it you're teaching?
Well, I think I'm teaching people the history of my own country, which is a curious microcosm out there on what the French call the façade atlantique, the Atlantic shores of Europe, which has a lesson in it for so many people.
Isn't that part of why you're getting this tremendous response in the United States, is there are so many Irish among us?
56 million. A cool niche, I would have said.
Yeah.
If you want a niche market, go for one that's got 56 million people in it.
We have a young friend who is just back from Australia who brought us a map that matches one that we brought back from New Zealand that says Down Under no longer, and it has done this wonderful thing. It just flips the compass, and it puts Australia and New Zealand up here, and then everybody else down here. So it's what we think of as the Southern Hemisphere becomes at the north of the map, if I'm making that clear. And you know, and it's very startling. I mean, I have literally had people who are quite self-confident kind of come unglued over this map. And I once had a chief executive officer of a big company walk to the front where I was standing with it and move it. He couldn't stand it. He turned it over to his way of seeing, which said a great deal about him. But in a way, that's what you're doing with the Irish story. You're flipping the geography.
I'm asking a question that I'm trying to answer at the same time. How is it that this tiny island, which if you turned it sideways and squeezed it a little, would fit into the state of Connecticut, with 3.5-4 million people on it, how is it that this place daubed such a huge, wide green stripe all around the globe? Mm-hmm. Why do they turn the river in Chicago green every St. Patrick's Day? What other country has a national day all over the world?
St. Patrick's Day.
St. Patrick's Day. So that's the question I'm asking, and that's the question I'm trying to answer. I think it's got to do with what we started talking about first, which is story and expression. I think that's what it is.
The stories are just critical. The other part of this, and we've seen it, we did a program earlier in the week with two people from different perspectives looking at Tibet. And part of it, I think, is the diaspora. So many Irishmen and women
who left but never left.
Had to leave for a variety of reasons.
To survive. So
they were, and in some cases were deported.
Yes.
But they covered essentially the English-speaking world. Mm. So you've got, that's part of it. And I think that longing, that the having to leave instead of leaving voluntarily, instead of seeking a more brilliant future, just escaping an insufferable present.
And Bill, it's also what they brought with them. The first book I wrote was about James Joyce. I wrote a book for people who failed to finish reading Ulysses.
That would be a large audience.
It was a bestseller.
That's about 95%, I think.
It was a bestseller. And of course, in the course of that, I remembered and was reminded forcibly what Joyce took with him when he left Ireland. He said, I take with me as my only weapons silence, exile, and cunning. And I think that's a lot of what's been going. It worked.
And stories.
Frank Delaney will be with us when we return in a moment with a lot of stories. Please be with us when we return with the Paula Gordon Show. We're back with Frank Delaney. I'm Paula Gordon, Bill Russell. And oddly enough, a small little thing that goes through my life with me, it's about this big, maybe an inch and a half, it's a pig on which rides a little Irishman. This is my mother's gift to me, that one should always laugh. And as you talk about, I mean, a pig carrying a little person on it with a little funky hat, that's funny. Part of what I think both of you are talking about is this, in the midst of just incredible oppression, the Irish have been able to find something to laugh about to get them through. Don't you think that's part of this swath across the planet?
I hate to shatter this for you.
Uh-oh.
But I'm going to break it in little pieces.
Okay, I'll brace myself.
The pig was almost certainly made by an Englishman.
Uh-huh.
And the figure of an Irishman on a pig is as denigrating as any denigratory terms you have used for African Americans anywhere in the world.
So it would be denigrating of the Irish or of the pig?
Of the Irish.
Oh, I would have thought if the Irish was riding it, would be denigrating of the English.
It was the highest they could rise.
Oh,
now,
my God.
Here's an interesting thing for you. If you look at the history of the social history of Boston and Chicago and parts of New York, or London, or Liverpool, or Birmingham, or Manchester, the notices in the boarding house windows were not no Irish or Negroes. It was known Negroes or Irish. And I'm fascinated by an American electoral statistic. I love American politics. I've been immersed in American politics since I was 15, 16 years old. I've followed more closely than is reasonable. I'm convinced that the Irish vote in America has never, in its own constituencies, gone to African-American candidates. Because there was a very long time when they were almost vying with each other for the lowest place on the totem pole and where to get out. And the pig was an English image created by Punch magazine in London. When they couldn't beat us linguistically and they couldn't beat us militarily, they tried to beat us by association. So when they were unable to defeat us, they then began to associate us with the lowest
swine
forms of life. Absolutely. And I was involved for many years in London at the height of the bombings and the troubles, where I was a reporter for the BBC. I was involved in fighting, in pushing back the denigration of the Irish by a kind of racism. When the Race Relations Act in England was passed by the English government, the Irish were not included.
Amazing.
Amazing. So that was part of the late 19th century image of Paddy and the Pig. And if you go back to people like Currier and Ives, whose illustrations provide the jackets of my books, because they went to Ireland in the 19th century, they actually tried to produce posters to make this humorous. And that was the only thing of Currier Ives related to Ireland that did not sell in the Irish community. Mm-hmm. Where did it sell? Among the Boston Protestants.
So much for my funny, huh?
No. You should hold on to it. You should hold on to it because it gets better if you hold on to it and transform it. And that is a story.
A very close friend of mine did his dissertation on the Irish in New York City.
Yes.
And he being from Russian Jewish stock, I said, why would you, I mean, you've got all of these other stories, why would you go look at the Irish? And he said, because it's every story of oppression.
That's right. When Ireland came out, and I went on an author tour.
The book Ireland.
Yeah, the book Ireland came out, Ireland, a novel, came out in 2005, and I went around the country. I naturally expected that the people who showed up at libraries and bookshops would be mostly Irish. No, shock. 40-50% maybe, but a huge number of Indonesians, Chinese, Polish, Eastern European, Latin American, because it was about story. I remember going to a library in Minneapolis, St. Paul, where 400 and something people showed up on a cold evening in March, and I asked people to raise their hands who had Irish blood in them. Less than 50% of the audience. I was astounded. I assumed that I was working a niche, a sensible thing for a professional author to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, David McCullough does American history, whatever. Mm-hmm. This is a very sensible thing to do, in my view, as a profession. But then people started talking to me. It happened to me 2 weeks ago in Denver, where some Japanese people came up to me who had driven 40 miles to see me because it was about story. And when I did a series with the BBC called The Celts, the second highest audience outside the Celtic countries was in Japan because these were island histories.
Mm.
And I think people need, your Jewish friend, your Russian Jewish friend in New York, I think people are looking for exemplars from history to latch on to, almost in a medallion sort of way, almost as something they can handle and feel and touch, almost as an amulet, saying if a country like this can have a history, then I can quarry my own history and find out what it is that made me. And the Irish and the Jews, of course, very close affinity, if only for the fact that the Kellys and the Coens, they said, ran Hollywood. You know?
Well, that's no joke.
Yeah. Well, what you call a medallion, I think of, is myth, is those deep, profound stories that define who and what we are. We're all now so thoroughly displaced, or so many of us are displaced, that those stories become very important. It also, I think, the you can't talk about Ireland ultimately without talking about the politics of Ireland. Mm. A few years back, we had the opportunity to have a long conversation with a fellow who was one of the founders of SASO, the South African Students Organization, and had been essentially a freedom fighter, and had, you know, a much longer story, but had been involved in that struggle for freedom and for democracy.
And his name is Barney Pityana.
And within a month of that conversation, we had a conversation with Jerry Adams.
Uh-huh. A most intelligent man.
Indeed. A very intelligent and charming.
Charming man.
And really at the end of those two conversations, I'm saying there's something very common in. I mean, there's a perspective that's very that they share.
Congruent, really.
Congruent, and what it was they were both desperately committed to democracy. They cared deeply about democracy in ways that Americans have gotten out of the habit of caring about it. Yeah. But it was their, if you excuse the mixed metaphor, holy grail.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
It is what they were searching for, what they wanted desperately, and what they had committed their lives, physically and spiritually and emotionally, mm-hmm. to achieving for themselves,
yes.
but more importantly for their people. Mm-hmm. And I think that story and what you've done with Tipperary is to me, bring that back to life, put it in a context that we've sort of forgotten about. We take all these things for granted, and we're paying the price for taking it for granted. But that sense of the importance, the core root importance of that ultimately myth that is the democratic, that people can govern themselves, is very, very important.
It's where the soul is. It's where the soul resides. I mean, the point about this book, Tipperary, is that when the hero was born, the year 1860, which is when really the modern Ireland we know today begins, 85% of the land is owned by 15% of the people. The native people who have been on this island for 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years were completely dispossessed in order to provide a Protestant people for a Protestant monarch. Perfectly understandable politically, but not understandable democratically. Now, you raise a very interesting point, Bill, which is something that concerns me. And it concerned me all when I was writing Tipperary. I refuse to believe that people will not go on rebelling and having revolutions. And I can anticipate a revolution in the United States that is based entirely on a new kind of democracy, and that is the democracy of the right to have something. The democracy of the right to carve in to the pie. And this is not socialism, this is not communism, there's nothing of those things. But there are now super rich people. And they're now, by comparison, therefore, super poor people. It is out of balance. And it has gone out of balance rapidly. Within the last 15 years, it has gone completely out of balance.
And visibly.
And visibly. And you will know about it in the South more than I will know about it on the East Coast, where I live in a very prosperous community in Connecticut, which is the second most prosperous state in the Union, I believe. I see that democratization process taking many forms and going on and going on and going on. And if you want to see how that happened over the ages, over the centuries, Ireland is a terrific model.
Absolutely.
It was also, do we need to...
I was going to let us go away, but go ahead, and then we'll do it.
Well, I want to go back to Tibet. The reason I mention that is one of the people, actually both people, Tibet is a challenge for a lot of reasons. Tibetan people want to be free.
Yes.
They have an interesting...
They are free. They want to assert their freedom, is the way they put it.
That's right.
Independence or lots of different ways of describing it. One of the differences and one of the interesting things is the perspective is a different cultural perspective from at least at first blush from what we're accustomed to, and they also have a charismatic leader who's stunningly intelligent, worldly wise, lots of different kinds of things. But I found myself reading your book simultaneously with reading these other books about the history of Tibet, but also how to get out of this mess. And it seems to me the lessons, I mean, they're arguing for, at least some of them were arguing for a Buddhist capitalism, a Buddhist democracy, but not a theocracy, but predicated on those principles. And when we come back, the exploration of democracy, it seems, is central. The Irish perspective, the Tibetan perspective, the American perspective, and ultimately the world perspective.
I want to talk about that.
And we all will talk about freedom when we return in a moment. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. We are delighted that one of those people is Frank Delaney. Bill Russell, you were talking about Tibet. Well, we were talking about Ireland. We were talking in the context of both Tipperary and Ireland. And I want to add one more piece to this conversation about freedom. Going back to what Alex, I'm currently writing the website for Alexandra Fuller's conversation with us, so I'm really thinking deeply about that. She says that in Wyoming, which is being devastated by our greed, by an addiction to energy, by the oil and gas companies coming and ruining for centuries to come the land that is Wyoming. And she says in Wyoming, there still is, it is indistinguishable, the land and the people.
Oh, yes.
And as Bill was reading about Tibet and I was thinking about Wyoming, I was also able to put that template against Ireland.
Oh, absolutely.
The land and the people. That is somewhat less true in the United States because we are so, peripatetic and there's so much land and so few of us are actually rooted in the land. The rural part is, we are now way over the urbanization. But all of these things are relevant when you're talking about democracy.
The thing that startled me here when I came to live here 6 years ago, I've been coming over and back for 30 years. And I've always loved coming here. I love Americans. I love the fact that you can see the trace elements of so many cultures in this culture. You know, it's like a mineral discovery. And it's marvelous. I'm astounded by your timidity. Astounded by it.
Timidity?
Timidity.
Here we have all this bravado.
Timidity. If the French farmers have a dispute with the government over road tax or something like that, they block the freeways with their tractors. I've been caught in them many times. I was caught in one which they called Disputation de Pamplemousse because there was a row over grapefruit. So they blocked the highway from Paris to Marseille at several points with their tractors. They held up traffic for days, for days. I'm watching the gas prices go up here.
To the profit only of the gas companies.
By the hour.
Well, and
by the hour. I'm watching various other things. Let me give you another example. When the French had hostages in Beirut, every French news bulletin at nighttime on all the channels there began, after the introductory music and the titles, began with a photograph of the hostages and the names and the number of days in captivity, and then the news bulletin began. In other words, they shamed the government into doing something. In the United States, at the moment, there is a serious absence of people power. You're not pushing back enough. You're not saying, hey, this is my right here. Now, I see it in small towns. I see it wonderfully in Connecticut, where my neighbors are terrifically feisty, and if something is going through they don't like, we're all in there, and we're arguing about it and fighting about it. But I don't see it nationally, and here's my question to you. How often do you see coming out of Washington legislation that you think is for your good? Or that you think is even about you, for a second. Now, in Ireland, your hands are very much closer to the levers of power. You know, you damn well let them know this is not good enough. America can do that, but it hasn't been doing it.
Don't you have to factor in the media in this? Because our corporate media simply won't tell us these things.
That's part of it. I think this goes back to Ireland and South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You didn't have the pleasure of going to school growing up in America, so you don't know that America perfected democracy.
You don't know this.
This will come as a surprise to you.
And to most of the world.
And to most of the world, but not to us. Yeah. We were taught that basically item, and we had reached the apotheosis of all that was conceivable with respect to democracy. We had won.
And it was done.
So
the Constitution is wonderful, but it needs to be updated all the time.
Absolutely. But once you get to that state of complacency,
mm-hmm.
and not only that, but people will still tell you, they'll talk about the pendulum of history, it always swings back. Well, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it falls up and just keeps swinging.
Yeah.
I mean, we forget that, but we literally believe that it will fix itself, that we have created a form of government, perfected a form of government. And this is, I think, the degenerate myth that we're operating on, that essentially does not require any active intervention. It's running on automatic pilot. So all we have to do is cash our paychecks, enjoy the good life, and this magical formulation will allow us to live.
It's not like that, Bill.
Really?
Flash!
No, in Ireland once.
You're in the news business, aren't you?
In Ireland once, they tried to get rid of the proportional representation system in exchange for the single vote. It meant that the ruling party at that particular time, the majority party, would have been in power forever. So they twinned it with a presidential election. It had to be a referendum because the constitution has to change. They twinned it on the ballot paper with a presidential election to vote back into presidential office the great godfather of the Irish state, Eamon de Valera, for his second term of office as president. He was retired. He was out to grass. It's an honorary situation. So on the ballot paper, they said, vote yes to making Mr. de Valera president for another 7 years, and vote yes to the abolition of proportional representation. There was no possibility. You either voted yes, or you left it blank. So you ticked the box for the psychological implication was you ticked the box for President de Valera, and you ticked the box automatically. De Valera was voted back, as he should have been, as president for another 7 years. He was then in his 80s, by a huge majority. By an even bigger majority, they rejected the other measure.
By not voting for it?
By not voting for it. By an even bigger majority, they said, we're not going to be fooled by this. We like our voting system, thank you. Now clear off. That's how sophisticated the Irish electorate was. We have a ballot paper where you vote
down the
paper.
How did you make that happen? Was it neighbors talking to neighbors?
I think people are very hip to their, they love their own political system. If I'm living in Ireland, my mother, when the ballot papers were published in the paper beforehand, she would go down that list. There were 15 candidates. She would go down that list and see who had done the most good in the area. And she would vote according 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, because the votes are transferable. When one man's elected, his surplus is transferred and divided among the others and so on and so forth. It's an incredibly fair system. And it produces really good public servants because people know if they don't perform, they're voted off. And she would go down and say, well, I haven't seen him for 2 years. He's not getting my vote. Anyway, she'd vote 1, 2, 3. She'd give everybody a vote and she'd write 1 or 2 or 15. Number 15 might get the first vote and so on and so forth. And that system worked better. And therefore, if the Prime Minister wasn't performing, he was out. Here, you have a president for 4 years and that's it. You can't do anything about it. You're locked for 4 years, 6 years in the Senate, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's a different system. And I think that all of these things, I think we will see changing in our lifetime because the world will force it.
One of the, it was Darth Kern's Goodwin who pointed out a good Irishman.
She's wonderful. Yeah.
That what she discovered in writing about Lincoln, the standard question in America was it slavery or was it union?
That he was fighting for in the Civil War.
That the Civil War, I mean, that was the motivator, the driver behind it. And what she said she came to after years of research.
10 of them.
Which she was very diligent about. Was that it really was neither. It was his deep, profound belief that people could govern themselves.
And that he told us that in the Gettysburg Address.
And it's all there. I mean, you know, that neat little succinct statement. Yeah. But that governing process in a non-static environment, and we all talk about how much the world is changing, the definition of the social relationship between and among us is right there in the way we govern ourselves.
Absolutely.
And we should expect that to change, which means...
But it should be mutating all the time.
Precisely.
It's an organism.
It should be evolving.
Absolutely.
Evolution applies.
Absolutely.
Co-evolving.
Yeah. Well, yes.
It is interesting to me. I have a favorite part, having only read 2 of your books. I'm sorry, you've got 20, but my time is of a constraint.
There have only been 3 books published here.
Well, then I'm only a third off.
So you're 2/3 rather. That's right.
Thank you.
You're doing very well.
At the beginning of Ireland, you go through and say, and this is right on point, and give a lyrical introduction to the land itself, the physical ejection, I guess I'm looking for, of the land mass out of the core that is the planet.
Yeah, yeah.
And you tell me that it's always on fire down there.
Yeah.
And you give me a context that is deeply moving both emotionally and physically, and there is a sense of continuity from the very moment that this landmass comes out of the molten core, and it's as if you have the Irish, I now you get to be the Irish for me, it's as if the Irish had a sense of the wholeness of that, and the fluidity, and how things do change, where the mindset that Bill is describing is very doctrinaire, it is cut and dried, it is still pre-Darwinian, and it doesn't account for the fact that there's always change.
There's always change. It's so interesting that you say this, because when I wrote this book, I realized it would also have to be read in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh,
and?
Because, as Dr. Johnson said, the Irish are a very fair people and never speak well of one another.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson.
And George III said, should you ever seek to roast an Irishman upon a spit, he will always find another Irishman ready to turn it.
Oh, dear. And
anyway,
so?
So I thought that, you will concede that Islander novel is a flamboyant book. It is flamboyant verbally. It is flamboyant intellectually, it's flamboyant emotionally, and that's the way it is. It is what it is. And therefore, I was afraid that when it was read in Ireland, oh boy. And of course, yes, there were the usual axes grinding, you could hear them in the background.
Mm.
A very interesting thing has happened since. I meet Irish people whom I really respect, who have never said anything in public about this book, and there's been a lot of debate about it in Ireland, as you can imagine. Who very quietly said to me, you got it absolutely right. That's exactly how I felt. A couple of weeks ago, I had the great, great privilege of meeting a former colleague of mine whom I haven't met for 35 years, probably the Irishman I most respect. He's a very quiet man. He was a wonderful, wonderful radio and theatre producer. He founded the Irish Folk Theatre. He's a Catholic priest, lives down in the southwest, lived a very quiet life. A man who taught me a huge amount about communication.
Will you tell us his name?
His name is Father Pat Ahern. A-H-E-R-N. He's a remarkable figure to me. Very, very important to me. And somebody had just given him this book. And I said to him, did you like it? Heart of my mouth, he said. I did. That's all I need to know. Therefore, here's the point. That's the long answer to the point you're making, Paula. I can't be alone in feeling this immense, fiery power under my feet as a child and as an adult. It seems to me when you go to Ireland, you are so connected to the land because there's so little of it. And recently, in this novel I've just finished, I was looking for a really very important metaphor to summarize why one character was so awfully the way he is. And I remembered something as a child that I'd heard, a mythological effect called hungry grass. And hungry grass is a kind of folktale phenomenon whereby you're walking across the fields and suddenly you're crossing a patch of earth and you feel an extraordinary degree of the pangs of famishment. You're famished, you're suddenly hungry. And the theory was that you are crossing a famine grave. That this is where people who died from no food were buried. Now, you see what has happened? The actual mythology of the creation of the country is taken in the 19th century and updated. So the myth goes on. So what we have that has been such a huge power to us and a huge example to us, because after all, we are unique in that history is usually written by the winners. In Ireland, it was written better by the losers. It goes on, and that's where we got our power from, our psychic power, this tiny island. America only has to find that within itself to become once again the greatest nation on earth.
Frank Delaney has told you. Now we will listen more when we return. What a pleasure to be with Frank Delaney here on
Pleasure's
the Paula
mine,
Gordon
sure,
Show.
Yeah.
Bill Russell?
I wonder, and part of the oppression, the reaction against outside forces in Ireland has had, just on the benefit of the English, 800 years of that. Ireland has become very prosperous, at least to an outsider's perspective. The EU's projects and processes had been just screamingly successful from an economic standpoint with respect to Ireland. And I'm curious how that newfound prosperity Northern Ireland aside, because that's a different animal, how that has affected the kinds of things you're talking about. Has it modified, changed, updated, subverted?
People will tell you that, you know, affluence always destroys the ancient roots. I don't think that's the case. For example, Irish traditional music is prospering as never before. It's got the biggest audiences it ever had in Ireland itself. Mm. People are still speaking the Irish language. There is a flowering of writing coming out of Ireland. Powerful writing on all levels, on the most popular level to the most esoteric and intellectual level. And there's some some of the greatest poetry of our time is coming out of Ireland at the moment. Poets like Paul Muldoon and Seamus Heaney. Paul Muldoon is now the poetry editor of the New Yorker. A magnificent poet. And this, you could argue, you could make the case of saying that this is a kind of pushback against their affluence. I've just come back. They've had a reality check recently in that property prices, which were very inflated, are beginning to drop. But there is something very interesting that has happened. They're looking after the country more beautifully than they've ever done. Mm-hmm. It is now such a pleasure to drive through the motorways around London, around Dublin, the freeways around Dublin, which are now full of beautiful plantings and blossoms. Some are still pretty crummy. But there's a sense of pride in the country that I didn't notice before when I was growing up. I grew up in a country where there was dire poverty. We were very comfortably off. My parents were teachers. My father had an income from writing. My mother had an income from property. So there were four incomes in the house. We always had a car. My father had a car before anybody else, I think, in the area. But there were 60% of the parish had no visible means of support. That's gone. That's completely gone. And let me give you one graphic example. My wife and I were driving over to the west of Ireland. I was taking her to the source of the River Shannon, which is such an important part of this new novel. And we were coming to a little town called Carrick and Shannon. And I said, now, this is a sleepy little place. This is a typical Irish town in the North Midlands, so to speak. And we drove into Carrick and Shannon. And on the outskirts of what was the old town, there is a new town with hundreds, if not thousands, of houses. Brand new, beautifully appointed, big local stores, supermarkets, do-it-yourself stores, everything. And I said, my God, I said, I haven't been here for 15 years, but how could this have happened? So I said, let's drive in and see. So we drive in, and we drive in, and we drive in. Boom! There ahead of us is Bank of America Customer Service Center. Mm. Because the American firms have come in, and what have they found there? They have found the most educated workforce in the world. They're on a tax holiday. This comes back to a point you made earlier, Bill. They're on a tax holiday. The Irish people have used their own education to provide the service for that tax holiday, hence the affluence. Now, this is what happened. When we were oppressed for many years, we kept going an underground service of the oral tradition, narrative tradition. We told ourselves our own history.
Because you could not do it formally.
Exactly.
You were prohibited.
When we then were allowed to do it, we became superb at it, and we used the language in a way that the English never could. And now we therefore depended upon America for a huge amount of our economy. We've now gone on rewriting the form of expression, this time in terms of education, that has kept us alive for centuries and now made us prosperous. We have a hugely rich, intellectually rich workforce. Ireland is booming, but now it's settling down. The excess will drain off. The body will become fit again. And I think out of that, you're going to get even greater expression.
That's very
exciting. So we should be taking notes.
It's very exciting.
But
this is my view. Maybe other people will disagree. I bet you Gerry Adams would have something not dissimilar to say about the potential of what's going to happen.
I think so. He is incredibly, to me, optimistic, considering what he's telling. Which brings me, luck is an acronym for the law of unintended consequences. We were in Wales a few years ago at Festiniog, and it turns out, Rado, as you know, but I didn't, within 12 miles as the crow flies is the prison where a lot of these Irish Republicans were imprisoned.
1916, yeah.
And the luck piece of this is that turned into a university. I mean, the British were treating these as terrorists, and they were
It was known as the Fenian College.
Yep. Exactly. But this that became the training ground for what led to the independence of a substantial part of Ireland, to me, is a remarkable story. Mm. And it goes to the ambiguity of narrative, particularly the one you're living right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, before you do that, I'm going to take a break so that I don't have to interrupt you. How's that?
Okay.
Paula Gordon, wishing all of you well and wishing you to come back in just a moment with Frank Delaney. Couple more minutes with Frank Delaney. Bill Russell has brought up exactly where I wanted to be, of course. I am Paula Gordon. What I wanted to say is you can't talk about Ireland and not say yes and. It is not yet resolved. We did a program many years ago with Don Oberdorfer, who said, well, of course Korea is going to be one country. It's just a matter of time. Yes. When we were with Gerry Adams, it was that same sense of, well, of course Ireland is one country. Right. It's a matter of time.
That's right.
The English still think they have an empire and we're it.
I know. It's the last, Ireland and Gibraltar, the last two little rocky outposts.
I'm curious about in this context, luck of the Irish.
Law of unintended consequences of the Fenian College.
How does this work?
The luck of the Irish is a very mercurial thing. And it is not luck at all, in my view. It is based entirely on the fact that because we're Celts, an ancient, proud European race, we can do something that almost no other race has ever been able to do. We can hold utterly opposite beliefs simultaneously. I say something to my wife, my WASP, Manhattan, born, bred and buttered, as I call her, New York wife. I say to her, whose family founded Old Saybrook and places like that, came over with the posts on the boat after the Mayflower. I say something to her, she said, but you said exactly the opposite yesterday. I said, so? That's how we make our luck. Luck is always a matter of collisions. Luck is also unexpected collisions. And we are always fusing. The Irish are always fusing. Things are always breaking off each other. One of the things that I try and point out to people, which fascinates me, is our sense of decoration. We take something and we decorate it. You know, when they're carbon testing something to find its age, they carbon test to destruction. Destroys what you're testing. Well, we decorate to destruction. Look at an Irish tune.
And you base it in nature.
Absolutely. Look at an Irish tune. Look at the Book of Kells, where if you boil it down to the illustration, it all begins with the tendril of the honeysuckle, which is taken and teased and pushed and teased, and then mutates into something else and then comes back. It's just like listening to an Irish tune. When you allow the mind that kind of unfettered imagination, then you are making, you are the legislator of the law of unintended consequences. I think it was Shelley said that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. Well, the Irish are the unacknowledged luck makers of the world. You make your own luck. And the more you try, and the more you push the imagination, and the more you put pressure on what the imagination can yield, it's said we only use 10% of our minds anyway, then you get luck. And it's extraordinary.
I had an uncle who literally, he had traveled the world, but he would not die until he had kissed the Blarney Stone. And for him, it was very important. It was he who always said, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
That's right. That's right.
Well, what you're describing is evolution, and Paula corrected me earlier and said it's co-evolution, and that is precisely what you're describing, this conflict between different ideas, animate, inanimate.
That's right.
Throw it all in together.
I see no difference. And I see no difference between them.
Well, don't you also, as you tell this story, I keep hearing that the Irish never divorce themselves from that of which we are all utterly apart, which is the natural world.
I have if you ask me what is the most passionate belief I have about myself as a writer, it is this: I am browless. I am completely without brow. I am not lowbrow, I am not middlebrow, I am not highbrow. Because the moment you create brow, the moment you allow brow, A, you're dealing in things like reputation, which is none of your business anyway. Time decides that, not other people. It is time decides reputation. But B, the moment you apply a brow, you're putting up a ring fence, you're putting up a steel chain fence around whatever it is you're trying to do. If you let in everything, if you let in every sort of emotion, every sort of thought, you can go anywhere in your life and in your imagination. And I think I learned that. I think I imbibed it. There's a wonderful thing that the Spanish have called the duende, the spirit of the duende. The dancers have it and the guitarists play. And it is that spirit that comes up from the red earth and seeps up into your body and infuses you completely. Well, there's a kind of Irish duende which should be browless. We are browless in politics. We are browless in things like golf, which is a classless game. Horse racing, we are browless. There is no brow. The moment you start introducing brow, and the moment people start giving themselves literary tags or intellectual tags, you limit this wonderful Irish imagination. I've never been to university. And my English friends always said to me, that's why you're so versatile. Because if you had gone to Oxford or Cambridge, they would have put you in channels like that. In Ireland, you can't do that to us. We are much too free and unfettered. That's ultimately why we become such a great model for democracy. One final note. The World Health Organization in the 1940s discovered in the world a perfect model for the study called epidemiology, which is the scrutiny of a disease in a population. What was the country? It was Ireland, because it was so utterly self-contained and yet so outward-looking.
In the last 30 seconds, there is the difference between an open system and a closed system. Mm. One encourages life, the other ends it. Aren't you describing an open system?
I'm describing an open-closed system. Or a closed-open system.
Ah, the Irish in you will outwit it.
That would be the contradictory part. There you go.
Thank Delaney.
Thank you both so much. This has been a pleasure.
As it has been for us. Thank you.
The books Tipperary and Ireland both are remarkable points of entry into one ancient story of oppression and liberation. The startling relevance of all of Ireland's stories reverberates throughout today's world. We thank Mr. Delaney for keeping these stories alive and for doing so here with us. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.